This show is part of the Electric Agora network of podcasts.
All right. Welcome to another episode of Sophia, which is part of the Electric Agora network of podcasts. I'll be loosely interviewing Kevin Curry Knight, who is a professor from East Carolina University, and I am Robert Gressis. I'm a professor at California State University, Northridge. And today we're going to be talking about the concept of Kafka traps. Kevin has written three articles about them. We're going to discuss what he has to say about those, what he has to say about Kafka traps in those articles. But before we do that, we have to do something I always like to do in any time I talk to somebody, which is small talk. So here is, I like to start my small talk with a question because this is a way of bonding people together. And after this, Kevin will be a lot less.
I feel pretty close to you though already though.
You're going to feel closer.
No, I feel, well, okay.
Yeah. Every time I ask somebody a small talk question, I start to get more texts from them, gifts in the mail, that kind of thing. This is really a money-making enterprise for me because I just sell the gifts to strangers. So here's the question. You're on campus. It's a normal day, but it's sort of after school has ended, so there aren't too many students on campus. Somebody you don't recognize. They look young-ish. They could be a student. They could be a faculty member. They could just be somebody completely unrelated. Runs up to you. Okay? This person seems very distraught, perhaps, or intense. Clearly, they're quite concerned. They say to you, come with me if you want to live. What do you do?
I don't believe them.
You don't believe them. Do you look around?
I guess probably for a little bit.
Yeah.
And because it could be there, it could be there's something around here. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess I could ask a follow up, which is, what are you talking about?
There's no time, man, is what he says.
I don't believe that.
You don't believe that?
Because you had time enough to tell me.
Well, what if he
you
starts
had time enough to come up to me and tell me?
What if he came up to you and then he started, after he said that, he started immediately running away without even waiting for your response? Would you find him more or less trustworthy?
No, see, the thing is, we've had, you know, like the street preachers and ECU's campus and stuff enough that I think the general thought is just another crazy day.
Have they ever tried to do that to you, though?
No.
It's one thing to go up and say you're a sinner who deserves damnation. You and I both know that's true. But on the other hand, if somebody comes up to you and says, follow me, it's important, and then they start running off. I bet the street preachers have never done that.
They've never done that. But yeah, so you could imagine that it's of a piece.
What would it take to get you to follow this person? What would they have to do? I'm going to write this down.
Oh, man. Just in case it happens and you can take the advice.
If I need to convince you that something terrible is going to happen, what if I, I know what to do. I wouldn't say come with me if you want to live. I think that's the problem. It's too vague.
Well, right. I mean, you'd need some reason that seems really plausible. And the more personal details are in that information, the more likely I'll be to believe you. You know, it's like...
Wait, the more personal details, like come with me if you want to live, my social security number is?
Well, personal details about like, you know...
You mean specific details?
They'll say something about like, you know, a family member, specific name.
Yeah.
Is in danger at, you know, a specific place where I know that person is or something like that.
What if they said there's a shooter on campus? You would wait until you got the alert on your phone?
I would probably look around to see if what other people were doing at that point and kind of gauge my response.
It's going to be tough to get you to do this, right? If not everybody else is doing it, you're not going to.
It's not like I'm a lemming, Rob.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. I base this on something that happened to me.
Oh, okay.
So when I was this is deeply rooted in my personal history. Yeah.
Great.
Actually, it's happened to me twice. The first time I was 17, I was taking a singing lesson in downtown Dayton. And this was not a great part of town. It wasn't the worst part of town, but it wasn't a great part of town. As I was leaving the church where I was having the singing lesson, another young man, probably older than 17, but not much, he yelled at me across the parking lot. hey, come here. And he was like, he was just behind the church. So I couldn't see past him or the church. And also nobody from the street could see either. It was a very secreted off point. And I said, why? And he said, I want to tell you something. And I said, what? And he said, he said, just come here. And I said, no, thank you. And then I got in my car and I drove off.
That's a good call.
Yeah. So I don't know what would have happened. He could have told me some very valuable information, or he could have stabbed me. One of those two is likely, I think. More the stabbing. The second time that happened is I was in a strip mall, and I was about to go into Woolworths, back when there were still Woolworths. And there was a guy, he seemed to be physically disabled, or he had a limp. He was far away from me, though. He was like, I don't know, 200 feet away from me. And he yelled down at me. He goes, hey, come here. And, you know, I said, why? And then he said, because I want to kick your ass, F word, right? He called me the F word.
Okay.
A slur for gay people. And I said, no, thank you. And then I went into
declined the invitation.
Yeah. Yeah. Although now that I think about it, it wasn't a Woolworths. It was a Kroger.
It's interesting that he invited you.
Well, he couldn't get to me because he had like a leg problem.
Right.
But then, and I thought to myself, I wonder, maybe I should go down there. Maybe it's important that I like help him with his confidence issues or something.
Right.
But then I actually went back out, and then I saw a car of people drive up next to him, and they were very loud and talking loudly. So I thought, this wouldn't end well for me. So, So I went back into the Kroger's and I went shopping for groceries.
I mean, all this reminds me of probably the closest thing that's ever happened to me like this. Isn't nearly as exotic as that story.
Oh, wait, Kevin, I'm going to have to stop you because this was the end of small talk.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. All right. So let's get to your paper.
Now I feel closer to you a little bit.
Yeah.
Hey, come here. I want to kick your ass, Rob.
I mean, who knows when that would work on me, but I definitely gave it some thought. Like, okay. Anyway, Kafka traps. So what's a Kafka trap?
Yeah. Well, a Kafka trap is, well, first of all, the term was created by a computer scientist, I guess, probably computer engineer or coder, like a software guy named Eric Raymond. Like 10 or so years ago, he put a blog post out where he calls this technique a Kafka trap. And a Kafka trap is, probably be best to just give an example. Mm-hmm. Rob,
yes?
Are you a communist?
No.
See, you're such a good communist that you're so good at the denial aspect, and you probably don't even realize that you're a communist at this point. So, of course, you're going to say no. So I'm going to ask you again, Rob, are you a communist? I really want to know.
Well, hold on now. If I say yes, I'm a communist, that means I'm a communist, right?
Well, yeah.
And if I say no, I'm a communist, that is also means I'm a communist?
Well, if you say, yeah, if you refuse, no, I'm not a communist, that
that's what a communist
would be evidence
say.
To me that you're a communist, because I'm already inclined to think that you either don't know whether you're a communist, that you can't really appraise that, or you would deny it, and that's just part of your communism. So a Kafka trap.
So like no matter what I say, you're going to take it as evidence that I'm a communist.
It's an accusation or a question where I've already sort of made up my mind that you aren't in the best position to appraise what's really going on or disclose what's really going on. So whatever you tell me back, I'm either going to believe you because you confirm my hypothesis, or I'm going to disbelieve you because clearly you're not in a position to be able to give me a straight answer or the right answer.
So
and that is a Kafka trap.
So hold on. Before we go on to Kafka traps, there's this. So what you've said so far is that it's a question or accusation where no matter what the person says, what they say will give you evidence that they are what you accuse them of being.
Yeah.
And the reason with communism, the reason that I'm you can't take my denial of my being a communist, you can't take that as evidence, is that if I were a communist, I wouldn't, it's quite possible I wouldn't know I'm one. Right. And it's also possible that if I were a communist and I knew I was a communist, I would deny being a communist. Is that the thought that right. you're either right. the kind of person who is ignorant of your own sort of mental states or whatever that's relevant to this determination, or you're somebody who, if you weren't ignorant, would be deceitful about it?
Right.
Okay. All right. So that's, although, and yeah. if it's, but you wouldn't always be deceitful, right? You're the kind of person who wouldn't be above deceit. So like a communist can say they're a communist if like they're that's quite right. confident, right? So it's right. not like a pathological lying thing. Okay. So yeah. So this is what a Kafka trap is. Okay. So it's a rhetorical technique, or it's if not a rhetorical technique, it's an attitude to an interlocutor.
Yeah, I would say that. It's several folks in response to the articles that I wrote pointed out something I think is a good point. The term is misleading, and most of them focused on the idea that the Kafka part is misleading. And what Eric Raymond meant was there's a book called The Trial that Franz Kafka wrote about a protagonist who's arrested, told he's committed a crime, isn't told what crime. And the part that makes this a Kafka trap is when he is in front of the court at some point, it's made clear to him that any denial on your part just confirms that we know you're a criminal. Mm-hmm. So he's put in this awkward position, whether deliberately or not. But some folks say the novel is more complicated than that, and it is. So the Kafka part is inaccurate, but the trap part is also, I think, a little bit inaccurate, because a trap is usually something that's deliberately set. So mm-hmm. we think of a Kafka trap as this deliberate thing. And I think mm-hmm. when Eric Raymond wrote the article, he was talking about, he thought this was kind of a deliberate strategy on some people's part. And I wouldn't deny it's a deliberate strategy on some people's part, but I would deny that it's that whenever you see that sort of technique, it's a deliberate setup.
Right. So Kafka traps, first of all, they might not be Kafka-esque because it's not clear that Kafka was talking about them. And second of all, they might not be traps because traps imply a level of intentionality or design that these things don't necessarily yeah. have. They might kind of arise spontaneously yeah. because of other things you believe about the world or yeah. your interlocutor. Yeah. But before we go on to, we don't really have to spend time on the Kafka part, because the point is that the name yeah. Kafka trap is quite evocative. Even if it's not what the yeah. actual Kafka thinks, it's the sort of thing where that's the association people have with Kafka. And second of all, yeah. Even if Kafka traps aren't intentional, I don't know that if you believe in a trap, you have to be wedded to the idea that it's intentional, right? You might imagine that that like a Venus fly traps insects, right. but it doesn't like do it on purpose exactly, because they right. don't have purposes. They just, or intentions, they just.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if we can think, can we think of a human, something we would call a trap that is in some sense set by humans or created by humans that we wouldn't say is also intentional.
I mean,
I have trouble thinking of examples. There may be some, but
the only example I can think of are, there might be some traps in chess where you might say that a person has stumbled into a trap and he didn't mean to, and the opponent didn't set it because he didn't think he would make that mistake.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So, right, but I right. mean, you might have people quibble with that being called a trap as opposed to just a blunder.
Right. So maybe the idea of trap could also just be interpreted as more on the user end, more on the experience, the person who's in the trap will experience it as a trap, regardless of whether it was
yeah.
deliberately set. Like, I can't say this and I can't say that, because either way, the person's not going to, you know, change their mind about me.
Yeah. But so, here's the point. I mean, Kafka yeah. traps sound cool. I remember it, Kafka trap. And here's the other question,
okay, but there's another term that I do like better. It's just a longer term, mm-hmm. and it was created by former Nexium members. So people who've read my articles know that, like, I'm obsessed with this cult or former cult called Nexium, mm-hmm. which was mostly in Albany, New York. But the founder Keith Raniere just got 120 years in prison. And their term, because they use this sort of thing all the time, is putting an issue back on its author. I mm-hmm. love that term. It doesn't, it, but then of course it is sort of by design, and the way they refer to it, certainly in Nexium, they thought it was by design when Keith Raniere and others would use this technique. But I really like that. I like that way of saying it because it emphasizes the idea that you are taking something, you're taking a discussion or whatever that you're having with someone and making the issue them rather than the issue. So the way that they would, the way this manifested sometimes was if a Nexium member would object to something that Nexium was trying to get them to do, like, you know, I really don't feel like I should be reporting how many calories I eat to you all so that you can keep me on a strict regimen. They would say, well, clearly you haven't worked through some of your issues. Like, clearly there are issues that are motivating what you're telling me that mean that you don't really object. You just have to work on your problems. Mm-hmm. And moreover, that's why you need our program. Mm-hmm. Because of things like that, you objecting to things. So that's why they called it throwing an issue back on its author.
And it's not, of course, just Nexium that employs no. Kafka traps. You've seen Kafka traps throughout history. Can you name a few examples of places where Kafka traps have like been practiced, whether by design or by accident?
Sure. Well, I think most cases of moral panic, there's mm-hmm. some sort of Kafka trap that is taking place. So even in the Salem witch trials, mm-hmm. There was the idea that if you ask a person whether they're a witch, mm-hmm. of course, if they're a witch, they're not going to tell you that they're a witch. Mm-hmm. So if you ask them and they deny it, that will become in itself some sort of evidence that they must be a witch. And yeah. if they get angry and really heatedly deny that they're a witch, all the better. Like, clearly we've touched a nerve.
Yeah.
So there's that. There is, we alluded to before, the McCarthy era. I had the intriguing yet maybe displeasurable experience recently of going back and reading J. Edgar Hoover's ghostwritten book, Masters of Deceit, mm-hmm. Where he outlines the communist threat to the country. Mm-hmm. And he'll say things like, of course, first of all, communists are so conniving that they would never admit that they're communists. Mm-hmm. But then he'll say things like, there's a group of communists. Communism is so much in the air in America that people can be communists and working for communism without even realizing mm-hmm. that they're doing it. And of course, that opens up the whole game. Like, once you say that these people are working for communism, but they're so, the brainwashing is so under the hood that they couldn't even tell you that they're communists. That opens up the whole charge of, if you say you're not a communist, well, man, there's at least two ways you can still be a communist, right? You could be dishonest, or you could just be misreading your own experience. So there's that. There was the moral panic, the satanic panic in the US, where there was the child daycare stuff. There's a recovered memory phenomenon of, you know, like, you're recovering abuse and stuff like that. And then what anyone who objects or denies that, like, this is going on, it's actually articles that were written by people who are, you know, thinking that they're uncovering people's repressed memories. And one of the things that they say in these articles is, if a child denies that they had any sexual abuse or trauma, keep pressing harder, because denial is just the first step towards admitting that you had some of this. And again, especially if they seem really annoyed after a while, like, why do you keep asking me this question? That is indication that you're onto something, right? Yeah. So, like, there's nothing the child can say at this point, that, because you've really already made up your mind and figured out how to explain that no answer. And of course, anyone who's an onlooker who's saying, this is insane, what's going on? Well, the sort of Kafka trap there is, well, you're just denying that this is happening because it's such a horrible idea to entertain, that you're just denying, you're just in denial about this. Right. So there's that. You know, I would even go so far as to say that certain modern variants of anti-racism can do this. I think like Robin DiAngelo's book, White Fragility, can traipse into this area where the idea is people who are racist don't necessarily know that they're racist. They just kind of drink it in. It's part of the culture. You absorb this thing. And then the upshot is if you are reading this book and you're reacting strongly to this book, the only possible explanation that D'Angelo entertains is that I've touched a nerve, and that sort of means you have to do the soul searching,
right?
And uncover the racism that I have already established is there.
About denials with Kafka traps. So imagine I'm trying to buy a new car from a car salesman. I ask him, is this a good car? He'll say yes. I'll say, is it a bad car? Is it worse than that of your competitors? He'll say no. When he says yes, I don't take that as evidence that it's a good car. When he says no, I don't take that as evidence that it's not a bad car or whatever, right? But I also don't take it as evidence for my view. Like if I think this is a bad car and I ask him, is this a bad car? And he says no. I don't take his no seriously, but I don't take it as evidence that it is a bad car. But with the Kafka traps, if you say, are you a communist? And I say no, you might say, well, that's not evidence that you're not a communist. But do they go farther and say, not only is it not evidence that you're not a communist, it is positive evidence that you are a communist.
Positive evidence that you are a communist. I don't think in the McCarthy situation that would have happened. Mm-hmm. I think they would have said, well, it's not really evidence either way, but it's definitely not disconfirming evidence.
Right. So like, yeah, if somebody's a criminal or we think they're a criminal and you say, did you do this? And they say, no, that doesn't make me more convinced he's a criminal.
Doesn't mean they're a criminal.
Right. Yeah. But it also, if I think he's a criminal already, it doesn't give me reason to think he's not. Right.
Right.
And this has come up recently.
Because you're already calling credibility into question. Yeah.
Yeah. About whether, like, you know, sometimes a no is evidence that somebody hasn't committed a crime, right? Like if you have a terrorist organization that loves to commit terrorism and then a terroristic event happens and you ask them, did you guys do this? And they say no. Well, generally when they do stuff like this, they brag about it. They say yes. So in that case, if they say no, that might give you some defeasible evidence that they didn't do it, right?
Right.
But maybe. I mean, I guess it depends on your attitude toward this terrorist organization. But okay, so that's an important feature of Kafka traps. So there have been Kafka traps in a wide variety of times and places. And you, though, you don't think they're always intentional. Why do you think people unintentionally deploy Kafka traps? Like, what is it about their attitude toward the world or what that makes them deploy them?
Well, I think there are several what we could call necessary conditions for Kafka traps. The first necessary condition is that you have to be able to posit that the person you're talking to either isn't an accurate gauge of what's really going on, in scare quotes, what's really going on, or they could very well be dishonest about what's going on. Once you posit that, you have most of the necessary conditions, or you put in most of the conditions in place for leveling or using or falling into the technique. But then the second thing you probably have to have on the part of the accuser is a belief that what you think about what's really going on is what's really going on. So I think that what's really going on is that you're a communist. I also think, because I've read Masters of Deceit, J. Edgar Hoover's great book, that you either don't know that you're a communist because, like he said, you might just drink it up from the air. You can't help but be a communist. Mm-hmm. Or if you're a communist, you have no problem lying about that. Mm-hmm. And if I already think that you're a communist and now I'm ready to doubt your ability to appraise your situation or your ability to be honest about your situation, that's all you need. If you have those two things, I think you have everything in place. And like one of the reasons I don't think this is deliberate is because I don't think either of those things are necessarily outrageous beliefs all the time. Like, I think we can pretty well establish with modern psychology, I mean, really, ever since Freud, at least, that we can say that there are things going on, let's say, quote unquote, under our psychological hood that escape conscious awareness, right? So as soon as you have that, you have the ingredient.
And to the extent that that's a plausible view, right? Like, I don't know, you know, there's going to be debates about the extent to which people take the subconscious to be a distinctively Freudian view, or whether basically all the elements of that were in place way earlier, like in Leibniz and in St. Augustine. But regardless...
Well, Foucault points out that some of those elements were very much alive in Christianity. Like the idea that the devil could be in you and working through you, and you would have no idea because the devil's just that good.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, like that... that you could, that the parts of you could be opaque to yourself, right? Yeah. To the extent that's a plausible idea, then that's going to open room for Kafka traps, right? It would be weird. I mean, it's not like if I said to you, are you hungry? And you said no, it would be weird for me to take that as evidence that you are hungry. And at least most of the time, because most people think we're pretty good at telling that we're not hungry.
Okay. Right. But there would be a situation
there can
where let's
be,
say
right.
you're, right. So let's say you're out with your spouse or something, and your spouse is a people pleaser and you're having a good time somewhere.
Right.
And you're like, are you hungry? And you know that your spouse knows that this means you have to stop everything you're doing and go somewhere. And there's just no way your spouse would be willing to do that to you.
Yeah.
And they say no. And you say, sweetie, come on. Like, tell me. Like, seriously, are you hungry? You haven't eaten for how many hours?
Yeah.
No, I'm good. I'm good. I'm good. Right. So, I mean, even there, it's just that it's that subtle.
Yeah.
But you're, again, in a situation where you're prepared to say this person is not accurately giving me the picture because they have some reason to deny.
Yeah. So in that case, they have a reason to be dishonest, right? They know whether they're hungry or not, but they have all sorts of reasons to say that they're not. And that's one view, that people can be deceptive, right? So, and that's got to have been a view that we've always had, ever since we've been at all sophisticated as like primates, right? But the view that people might not be being deceptive, but might be such that not only do they not know their state, but that you, who are not them, do know their state, right?
Right.
It's one thing to say that they don't know their interior life, but neither do you. It's another one to say they don't know their interior life, but you do know it better than they do. And so you're better positioned than they are to figure out what's going on in their head. That's maybe distinctively modern. I don't know, but regardless of whether it's distinctively modern, it's a plausible enough idea that Kafka traps can get some purchase.
Well, there's an interesting book by Thomas Saz.
A Myth of Mental Illness?
It's a book where I'm totally forgetting the title now, but it's a book where he compares the idea of modern psychiatry with the Spanish Inquisition.
Mm-hmm.
And his point is that within the Inquisition, you know, there's not a thing someone could say to say, just like, back off, leave me alone. I don't need your conversion. Like, the devil's not here. We're fine. You know, leave us alone. No, you're not. That's clear evidence. Like, see, you're so far gone that you really need our help now.
Yeah.
And he's kind of making the point that in a way, modern psychiatry works in a lot of the same ways. An acquaintance of mine, for instance, Deidre McCloskey, is a transgender female. And she talks about, she writes in her book, Crossing, that when she wanted to transition to female, she was locked up against her will because it was thought that she was crazy. And of course, the more you deny that you're crazy, the more the doctors are like, trust me, I know you're crazy. And part of the symptom is your denial, right? Like the fact that you're crazy, the denial would follow from that, because part of the craziness is not thinking you're crazy. So you need our help even more.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, I wouldn't call into question psychiatry quite the way Saz does.
Right.
Again, I think it's plausible that a depressed person may not know they're depressed, but a psychiatrist may be able to identify it. But yeah, I mean, again, it's a similar sort of thing. similar sort of Kafka trap situation.
Yeah. So but the book, by the way, is called The Manufacture of Madness.
Yes, that's it.
But that's the Thomas Saz book. But this is a bit peculiar to me because I do believe that sometimes parts of our interiority are not visible to us. And I also believe that sometimes those parts are more visible to others. But I'm sort of trying hard to think of a time when I would naturally think the most plausible view is that denying it makes it is more evidence that you have the thing I'm accusing you of. Like, I can see thinking that denying it doesn't give me any evidence that you don't have it, but taking the denial to be more evidence that you do have it. Okay. I mean, I guess the thought is, like, I can think about why you might think that if you believe the white fragility approach, right? Which is that racism is so pervasive that it's really impossible not to be racist if you're white.
Right.
And it takes only a little bit of research to realize that. And consequently, somebody who denies that he's racist shows himself to have not done even that little bit of research. And so if you haven't done even that little bit of research, the best explanation for that is that you are more racist than the average person. I guess that would be one way of getting to it.
Well, and they would look at not only your denial, but the strength of your denial. Like, you're getting red in the face. You're getting pretty angry here. Mm-hmm. Instead of taking that as evidence of people don't like to be appraised wrongly.
Yeah.
And I think you've appraised me wrongly. Mm-hmm. They take that as evidence of, well, clearly we've struck a nerve. Clearly there's something going on here. I think you're right. I think most of the time with Kafka traps, you wouldn't take the denial as dispositive evidence of guilt. You would take it as certainly not evidence of innocence. And you would take it as maybe the strongest would be, it's kind of mild evidence of guilt.
Mm-hmm. I think a denial can be mild evidence of guilt, but it's not the bare fact of the denial. It's going to be a bunch of other things that go along
with
it.
Right.
Like, so here's the thing. Imagine that you asked me, are you a communist? Right.
I think I did ask you that, Rob. And I don't think you ever gave me a straight answer.
Well, here's what I want to say. If we go back to that and you say, are you a communist? What if I had said, maybe? I don't really know. I don't know if I'm a communist. Is that a way out of the Kafka trap?
No, because J. Edgar Hoover already posited that you probably are, because you're part of American culture and you probably just brought, this is just an answer. This is just a response that shows how honest you are.
Well, I'm just going to say, imagine I said, look, I don't think I'm a communist. I'm going to be honest. I don't think I'm a communist. But on the other hand, I've read Hoover's book and I think it's a great book. I think it's very powerful. And so because I've read that book, I think maybe I could be a communist despite my thinking I'm not. So in answer to your question, are you a communist? My answer is, I hope not. I might be. And if I am, I'm going to try to work on that and be a better person who's not a communist.
Yeah. Right.
Well, is that an answer that would, like, satisfy the Hooverian?
Well, it would confirm their priors. I mean, all the answers are going to confirm.
Yeah, but their priors. But some answers are going to make them more convinced that I need to be worked on than others, aren't they? Right. If I strenuously deny and I get red in the face, that's going to seem to them more evidence that I'm a more hard-bitten communist. Oh no.
I don't think necessarily. I mean, like, so if you, I mean, think about, like, the Robin DiAngelo situation. If you say, yeah, no, you're right. You're right. I have drunk racism in, and I kind of feel a pang of guilt when you're talking about me being racist. So that probably is a sign that, that I'm right. I think she's going to see that as great. Sign up for the course.
Right. But I mean, doesn't she think then I'm less far gone than somebody who denied it?
Yeah. But the trap isn't trying to prove that you're far gone. Mm-hmm. The trap is trying to get you to admit what I know is obvious about you.
Oh, okay. And so basically,
that's what it is. It's not. Yeah, I'm not trying to prove that you're far gone. I'm just trying to say this is true about you. I happen to be in a position where I can gauge it.
Well, hold on. Now I have a question. You already know I'm far gone, right? That's what you believe going in.
I think the small talk proved it.
Right. Yeah. Right. But I mean, if you're somebody who believes in a Kafka trap, right? Yeah. Whether it's, are you racist or are you a communist or are you a witch or are you a child molester? Chances are you're asking me this question because you think I am the thing that you're asking me whether I am.
Yeah.
Why ask me?
I think that's a necessary condition.
Okay. So why ask me the question? Like you already believe
verification.
It. But it's so,
because I want verification.
So and any answer I give you gives you more verification.
Yeah.
And do you know this about yourself? Do you know this that, like, what happens to the person who's employing the Kafka trap? And then you point out to them, hey, any answer they give you is just going to be taken for you as more verification. Why not? Why even ask it? Because could that really be?
I think that response is the one response that could really flummox somebody if they're honest enough to kind of like think about it and say, wait a minute. Okay, that is maybe an unfair question. I am sure, I'm positive that people responded that way during the McCarthy era. I'm sure of it. I only don't know for a fact because I don't know the transcripts of the hearings, but I'm sure that it happened. I just don't think that anyone in that climate on the spot of communist everywhere side was ready to think about the possibility of that.
Okay.
And, oh, I do know that there were people during the child abuse, the satanic panic child abuse stuff, who were saying this. Like, look at, you're cornering these kids. What can they possibly say? Like, there's no evidence that's going to be strong enough for you. You're framing the questions in an unfair way. And those people were just kind of dismissed as, you're just in denial. You just want to figure out a reason why this can't be true. So we're not going to pay attention to you because we have serious work to do.
Yeah. So here's a question about Kafka traps. Do you think they arise, I mean, not only under these circumstances, but is the following set of circumstance quite conducive to their arising? You have two groups of people who have very different views of how the world works. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, take, your typical secular atheistic philosopher, right? And then your typical evangelical Christian apologist, right? Very different views of the way the world works. And I think the philosopher, the secular philosopher, and not always is this going to be the case, but often it's going to be the case that they think to themselves, how could anybody seriously believe this, right? How could anybody seriously believe that Jesus rose from the dead physically, that God exists and loves us, that he communicates with us, that he performs miracles, that this book is blessed, et cetera, et cetera. It's so hard for me, who doesn't believe any of this, to fathom how they could believe all of this, that I have to come up with a theory about how this is possible.
Yeah.
And the theory is going to be something like, they are stupid, they are malicious,
right?
They are ignorant. And then after that, I'm trying to think about you could also have the theory that they're just processing the evidence differently, right? And that, evidence is permissive and that there's all sorts of rational responses to the same evidence.
That's not satisfying to a lot of people, right? That's not satisfying to a lot of people.
And so the thought would then be that
because I see certain things so clearly that there's certain things I can't entertain that you could possibly interpret. Like, you can't possibly interpret the evidence that way. It's clear as day.
Yeah.
So I have to figure out how it's possible that you can interpret the evidence that way.
Yeah.
In the face of my strong belief that there's no possible way a thinking person could interpret it that way.
Right.
And then the Kafka trap is a great, great thing. It's a gift.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know if the secular philosophers take any evangelical Christian's response as further confirming their view, right? Like, let's say you ask, William Lane Craig, who's been coming up lately, why do you believe that God exists? And he might say the Kalam cosmological argument, and this is why, and he gives you the argument, and you're like, that's the worst argument I've ever heard. you can't, that can't really be your reason. And then he might say, well, why is it the worst argument? And you can have an argument like that. But if you really think it's that bad an argument, you might not find that. You might find the fact that he gave the argument to be further evidence that he's just malicious or stupid or something like that. And of course, just to cover my bases here, presumably the evangelical Christians also feel the same way about the secular atheists. Although I'm not sure it's exactly the same way, right? Because I think a lot of evangelical Christians have the experience of like being born again and sort of remembering what it was like before they were born again. And so they might not think that their atheist friends are stupid. They might just think they're evil.
Well, so I remember living in Nashville, Tennessee, being an open atheist and, in the Bible Belt, and Nashville probably wasn't as bad as some more rural areas, but I remember one of the ideas being like, well, you just haven't had a personal experience with God yet.
Right.
And I was like, well, that's true, but there's also all this evidence. And they're like, trust me, mm-hmm. if you have a personal experience with God, you can like, you wouldn't think that of that as evidence, right? You just haven't had, and so, yeah. And I guess you could say that kind of bleeds into a sort of Kafka trap a little bit, but I think it's an awkward fit. But you could say that it's like, but it's not the same to your point. They never said like, oh, you're not smart enough to appraise the evidence. It was more like you haven't had a personal experience.
Yeah. So perhaps So they might be likelier to say you're ignorant, and the secular atheists might be likelier to say that their interlocutors are malicious or stupid.
Yeah. There's a really good book by Catherine Schwartz, who I think is a journalist/novelist, mm-hmm. Called Being Wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like a phenomenological account and a journalistic survey of what the experience is of being wrong and then realizing that you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things she says there, like to our point, is that when you are wrong, the reason it hurts is because we're used to thinking that we have like this one-to-one map on the world where the world just appears as it is.
Yeah.
So the world appears to us this way. That's the way the world is. Being wrong is like this reminder that there's actually kind of a gap or two or three between the way we experience and interpret the world and the way the world, quote unquote, is.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things she says is that she doesn't think of this as a Kafka trap. I don't even think the term was invented when she wrote the book. It was several years ago. But she says there's like three techniques that people tend to use when they're in arguments about things they feel like are so clear and obvious that others don't see the way you do. The first is the argument from ignorance. Well, they just don't know the relevant data arguments. And once I hit them with that, they'll see it.
Yeah.
The second is once you do that and they still kind of deny it, it's like, well, they must not be smart enough to appraise all the evidence and argument that I just dropped. Because if they really appreciated it, they would know. And then the third, which is kind of the last resort, is, well, they must have some reason. Usually it's that they're evil in some way or they're duplicitous, where they're just denying the force of this. And what's not entertained is maybe the force of that is more a personal appraisal than it is kind of an objective feature. But I mean, without saying so, she really hit on the idea behind a Kafka trap. If you believe so strongly that the world is just full of communists, that the US is just overrun by communism, you have to explain away why very few people will ever admit to being communists. It seems like their number is small. God dang, I have to explain this. Or, the whole satanic abuse thing. Like, clearly I know this is going on in daycare centers. It seems so obvious, but the evidence is so like indirect. I have to figure out, like, everyone's denying it, but I know it's true. I have to figure out how to explain these denials in a way where I don't really have to grapple with the idea that maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's another interpretation. And the Kafka trap is a great non-deliberate way, or deliberate way sometimes, to do that.
It's a deliberate way to do what?
It's either a deliberate or non-deliberate way to explain at least some of the conflicting evidence in front of me that prevents
everyone
from seeing how obvious what I see is.
Because it helps give you evidence that the person is duplicitous or something like that.
Yeah, and this kind of takes us into how Kafka traps are so evident in so many cults. Mm-hmm. When I started really getting kind of obsessed with this idea, there's something going on here with this argument that's really weird. I want to identify it. Started looking at like cults and how they operate, and it's really common. So in the Church of Scientology, they teach you very early that there's two parts of your mind. There's the reactive mind, and there's basically the rational mind, and the reactive mind is basically what it is. I don't think the rational mind is the right term, but they're trying to basically clear out the reactive mind, which is responsible for all the negative stuff, mm-hmm. and really get you to be fully clear, which means you're using this rational part of your mind. And of course, the next step is saying, well, all of the criticisms of Scientology that you'll ever come up with and that creep into your head are part of the reactive mind, right? Ah. So that whenever you say, this doesn't make sense, they can retort and say, well, that's your reactive mind. See how much you need this?
Yeah.
And then, of course, NXIVM did the same thing, and Christian cults do it. You know, any denial is going to be seen as proof that the devil is working inside you and you just don't know it.
Yeah. And now let's talk more about cults, right? Because cults, I can certainly see cults using Kafka traps. You've mentioned NXIVM. You've mentioned, Scientology, which I guess we're treating as a cult.
There are political cults that also
right, use the same perhaps, sort of thing. Perhaps Marxist. Like
Maoist cults.
Right.
Yeah, like a Maoist group. So there's a group called the Democratic... called the Democratic Workers Party, and it was headed by Charlene Dixon, who is a former sociologist. And they were all about weeding out all of the bourgeois tendencies in members.
Yeah.
Right. So like one of the first things you have to do is you have to rigorously weed out any traces of bourgeois mentality left in you.
Yeah.
And of course, guess what was evidence of a bourgeois mentality?
It's denying it.
Having any problem with anything that's going on in this group. Well, that's just your bourgeois materialism denying it. Like, right. So if you were accused of having a trace of kind of the bourgeois mentality left in you and you denied it, well, you can't see it because it's so ingrained in you. Right.
So let's talk about cults in greater detail. Like what kind of people join cults in the first place? What kind of people run cults? Right. So my non-tutored sense is that the kind of people who join cults are people who are, to not put too fine a point on it, social failures, right? Where something terrible has happened to them, perhaps, or they've made a lot of terrible decisions, and then they can't find acceptance anywhere, and so they want to join this cult that promises them acceptance. And my similarly untutored sense about who runs the cult is generally some sort of sociopath or narcissist or something like that, who feels like he needs lots and lots of attention and power because that's how good and important he is. So am I right about those kinds of guesses, or is there more to it?
Well, I think the latter one is probably correct. I think that I can't think of an example of a cult that's been studied where the conclusion wasn't that the leader was just a kind of a narcissist who was just very full of themselves, knew what the truth was and wanted the attention, felt like they could handle that attention. The former, I think you're not quite right about. I mean, what I've looked at in terms of cults, and I'm getting this literature second hand by reading books by, you know, Janja Lelich and, Steve Hassan and those folks. Mostly the people who would join a cult are people who they could be social failures, but the number one predictor is that you have experienced recently a loss of meaning, maybe a loss of continuity. So it's usually at a point of vulnerability. I actually was a little blink away from becoming a member of the Scientology church in college.
Wow.
And I can tell you that what happened was I was walking down Newbury Street at Berklee College of Music, kind of right next door there. And a guy waved me over and said, "Hey, you want to take a personality test?" And for those who know Scientology, this was the abbreviated version of the Oxford personality test that they use. And I was at a point where I was like, yeah, I probably want to learn more about myself. And part of the reason I did that, by the way, big shocker, it turned out the results of my personality test indicated that I was in pretty big trouble. And I really needed, you know, work on myself. So they took me back to the church, their church in Boston, and I watched the video. You can watch, you see the video, the Scientology video online. If you look on YouTube, I think Scientology recruitment video, there's like a video that someone took with a cell phone. That's the video I saw. And the reason I was almost part of this church was because this was my first year of college. I went to a music college, Berklee College of Music. Everyone at Berklee is kind of like, it's almost like the Harvard for, you know, like music. You're a good musician if you go there. And usually you're like the best musician in your town. And I was one of the best musicians, at least in my town. But when you go to Berklee, you realize very quickly that you're probably pretty average, at least compared to this new group. You have this new sample to compare yourself to. And you're pretty average. And I think I was thinking at the point, I'm probably actually pretty below average in terms of drum set and percussion skills. Probably not going to be anywhere near the top of that list. So, you know, I'm 8 hours or so from home, living away from home. I have roommates that I can't stand, thinking, you know, probably not the best musician here. It's not what I thought it was going to be. And they right at that moment, "Hey kid, want to take a personality test?" "Yeah, sure. I'll take a personality test." And then I even remember when I went to this church and I watched the video and stuff, and I'm thinking, like, I'm kind of getting, you know, like excited. I'm like, wow, this thing seems like it's kind of, this could give me something. So I'm walking in the church building with what I later found out was would have been called a registrar, because his goal is to register you for courses. Walking through this place, and like, I remember vividly this mother and son crossing our path through one of the halls. And he made a big point of like, "Hey, Susan, hey, Ricky." And, you know, they were like, "Hey, how's it going?" And they stop and talk for a few minutes. And I'm like, man, this is pretty cool. So you're kind of craving that meaning in the community. And I also remember when I left the church that day, thinking like, if I were to join this church, I would have an experience that no one else at Berklee has. Like, this would separate me in a certain way from the chaff, right? Like, I already feel like I'm probably not a great musician, you know, compared to my other students. So yeah, that's kind of a long way of saying, like, I remember what it felt like to want to be part of a group like that.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that I was a social failure at all. I was at one of the best music schools in the country. And in fact, that was probably one of the reasons that pushed me. It was more like I was a success in a certain way, but that success didn't have any meaning behind it. And it kind of shook my core in some ways, and I needed something. I'm always shocked.
Shocked about that? You're shocked that more people don't join cults?
No, I'm shocked. So going back to Nexium, for those who haven't, there's two documentaries that have been, one on HBO called The Vow, which is an 8-part documentary series about some people who left Nexium. And then there's another one called there's another one on the Stars Network that India Oxenberg took part in. And it's the same sort of thing. And I'm shocked at how smart people who were in Nexium are. They're very smart. They're very articulate. Some of them were like professional actors. They're, you know, they were definitely not social failures. Yeah. These were socially excellent people.
So the kind of people who join cults then, at least a lot of cults, are people who, as you said, are sort of adrift in some way. And they see being part of a cohesive social unit as the way to give them direction. And so if you're in this kind of atmosphere, and generally cults are fairly small, right? I suppose they have aspirations to become quite big.
Yeah, generally it's almost by definition a cult would have to be small. If it's too large, it becomes a religion.
Right. Although, I mean, the thing is that I don't know too many religions, right? Established religions. I don't study them in great detail, but I don't feel like I know too many established religions that use the same techniques as cults, but I've also not studied them in great detail. So I don't know if the evangelical churches are just as harsh in making sure people, you know, join and also in making sure they stay. Maybe they are. That's not the way with the Catholic Church, I can tell you.
Well, it's, I think,
at least in my experience.
Well, I'm sure they use some of the same techniques. I mean, I've heard more than a few Catholics, you know, talk about what happens when you question the wisdom of the Bible or the priest in Sunday school. You're given all sorts of like, you sure you don't need some work on this? Like, you sure you good with your faith?
I never got that.
It may depend on where you are, but I know that's a fairly common story about like you learn pretty quick that you don't get anywhere by questioning those teachings. Mm-hmm. But then again, the Catholic Church.
Well, I was thinking the size.
More liberal stuff.
I was thinking the size mattered though, because like on the one hand, this group gives you a direction. And there's just a few people who've got it. So you feel not only like you have direction, but you're part of something special. On the other hand, if it got really large, then mightn't you feel the same way about that group as you do if you're like the first person to discover an indie band and then they make it big, then you all of a sudden it becomes less interesting to you? Like,
there's this really good story in the Stars documentary where Indy Oxenberg is talking about Nexium kind of went through this great kind of almost purge of people because their kind of requirements to stay with the group just got kind of stranger and stranger. So a lot of people just left because they just couldn't do it. And at the next meeting, Keith Raniere, the head of Nexium, treated this as like a really good thing. He's like, look, the people who are left are strong. You're the strong ones. Mm-hmm. Right, we didn't need the weak people. We want the weak people to get out of here. Look how strong you are. You've made it. And I mean, that's kind of a lesson. And yeah, cults often thrive on that sort of exclusivity. It's almost why, you know, one of the paradoxes with Scientology is the more people leave, the higher, the stranger it gets. And then the more people leave, you'd think that they would want more members, so they'd kind of taper that down. And I feel like what's happening is that the more people leave, the more the people who are left are the true believers, and the true believers want to be a small group. They get some real value out of like being one of the people who made it. And you don't get that if you're a large group, and you don't get that if the membership requirements aren't stringent.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm one of those people who, when I'm part of a really small group, I just worry about it dissolving, right? Mm-hmm. Like I worry. I also will think, huh? I wonder why so few other people are on board with this, right? And then I'm forced to come up with a theory, right, about all these other people, and then that makes me uncomfortable because I tend to be one of those people who thinks the evidence is pretty permissive. Like lots of beliefs are compatible with the evidence we have, So when so few people like glom onto one interpretation, I start to wonder like, maybe the theory should be about us and not everybody else.
Yeah. But then again, that brings us right back to the idea of the Kafka trap. Now you have a handy explanatory tool that really in a really easy way, it's easy, it's quick. You can figure out some reason why all of those people just don't know, or they're not in a position to know what's really going on. Or they're just denying it. Everyone's just denying the truth. So you think of like cults do this a lot. With Nexium, you were always, Sarah Edmondson wrote a really good book called Scarred. She's a former member. One of the things she recounts that other people have also recounted is early on in the first 5-day intensive seminars. You're told over and over again, the world has indoctrinated you with values that are designed in some ways to make sure you don't achieve happiness. There are people who maybe profit off you not achieving happiness. There's this false sense of values, and all of us have just drunk them in. And we're going to teach you the true values. But once you have that in place, you have a really good explanation for why you're such a small group, right? Like, we're just the chosen. We're just the ones who are able to awaken ourselves. Whereas everyone else, like all these other losers,
right?
They're not in a position. And then you see it in, you know, conspiracy theory groups. They have to figure out a reason why most people don't find the evidence that 9/11 was an inside job to be persuasive. And, you know, it's,
yeah.
Conspiracy theories are interesting because if you deny, if you deny the force of it, you're either just not in a position to appraise the evidence, or you're just part of the conspiracy, or it's evidence of how good the conspiracy is, right? It's just evidence of like, how good the conspiracy is.
That's the thing. You know, the funny thing about conspiracy theories is that by some measure I saw, something like 61% of Americans disbelieve the official story about JFK's assassination, right? So a majority of the population believes a conspiracy theory about JFK's assassination. But I don't know that I would call 61% of Americans conspiracy theorists. I don't know yet. I read this book about conspiracy theories called Conspiracy Theories by the philosopher Kasim Kassam.
Appropriate title.
I mean, that's what they want you to think. But one of the features of conspiracy theories, he lists six features of conspiracy theories. He says they're speculative, which means that they're based on conjecture. Right. So generally, conspiracy theorists don't have hard evidence of what they claim. Right. They have circumstantial evidence, and then they use an inference to the best explanation. But like, if they had hard evidence, then on Kassam's view, they would stop being conspiracy theories and would just become facts. Right. That like, okay, well, we found the second shooter. Like, there you go. Right. And so conspiracy theories usually don't have that. It requires you, the theorist, to make this interpretive decision, right? Which maybe gives you a sense of power and agency. And the thing is that partly because they're speculative, like they're also contrary to the obvious or the official explanation. So generally, you know, with the JFK case, there was an official explanation. And then the conspiracy theorists thought that that was not right. And that's part of what marks them out as conspiracy theorists. And so they speculated based on the evidence they had. And their own conclusions are usually esoteric, is how Kassam labels them, where it's the kind of thing that, not always, because, you know, clearly political leaders do get assassinated because of the machinations of other political leaders. But sometimes their explanations are quite esoteric. Like, you know, there's the chemtrail stuff and how the U.S. government is hiding aliens and, you know, the David Icke, I guess, lizard people thing.
Yeah. I think it's Icke.
Yeah, I think it's Icke, yeah. And then
he's kind of icky.
I never met the man, although from what I understand, lizard people really just means Jews. Like, it's supposed, the conspiracy about Icke's conspiracy theory is that he's trying to spread anti-Semitic conspiracy theories without appearing anti-Semitic. It just so happens that many of the lizard people are Jews. And that's a coincidence.
The Jews have been very susceptible to a lot of conspiracy theories throughout history. Have either been about Jews as like a covert, this is about Jews and we don't want to say it.
Yeah.
Or I think more just people have this idea about Jews as the other that makes them somehow uniquely prone to conspiracy theories.
Yeah, and Jews have always been a small group, and certainly lately have become quite a successful group. I'd be curious. I mean, I know the blood libel against Jews is quite old, but I wonder to what degree the fact that as a minority, Jewish people are fairly successful and small, how much those two things play into conspiracy theories being developed about them, or if it's just like historical inertia or something like that.
Yeah.
But that leads to three more features. So we've had speculative, contrary to obvious explanations, esoteric. Another feature of conspiracy theories is that they're amateurish. Generally, they're done by people who are not experts in the areas they claim to be. They're pre-modern. They tend to rule out systems.
So by amateur, she's not making a comment on, he's not appraising the evidence. He's saying, as a matter of fact, these people are almost never experts in the field of, okay, yeah.
Yeah, like for instance, one of the people who's a JFK conspiracy theorist is a guy named Richard Popkin, who was a philosopher. He died in the 2000s, and he was
Was his death an inside job?
He probably died of a heart attack because he was morbidly obese. So in a certain sense of inside, then yes.
That's what they want you to think.
He was a trained philosopher, so he was an expert in philosophy, but he was not a trained person, like forensic scientist, right? And that's what he wrote a book about it, and that's what his book was like, going over all the forensic science. And so here's the thing. I mean, we could talk about what the last feature that's most important is called self-sealing, where they don't take evidence seriously unless it's part of the conspiracy theory community. That's one way in which they're really like cults. And now they're also not one of the ones who, when you deny it, that's evidence that you're in on it, right? It's just, right. But of course, they might say that if the official theory denies something, then that's evidence that it's true. They might say that. So that they could be using Kafka traps that way. But, you know, I wonder to what degree, if you're a hard, like, there aren't that many hard-bitten conspiracy theories, I don't think, conspiracy theorists. And so to that degree, they might be a cult too, where it's kind of small, right? Like the average American, if you ask them, did JFK get assassinated by, you know, the CIA? Maybe they'll say, yeah, probably. And if you ask them like more, they probably don't know about it. They just are people who are like, I don't trust the government. The government does shady things. It wouldn't shock me if JFK was killed by the government. And that's about as far as it goes. So, but yeah, go on. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the sealed off part, that last prong of conspiracy theorists kind of brings us back to the idea of, Kafka traps are kind of a useful piece of that. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that, one of the features of cults, at least if you look at Steve Hassan's BITE model, what he calls the BITE model, is that the I is information, and cults like to control information flows. So the extreme version, you know, would be those types of cults that strictly regulate the flow of information. Scientology, if you're in one of their bases, you can't get media that's not approved. You can't get letters from friends and family that haven't been read by Scientologist folks. You can't buy certain books. You're not supposed to have them. Mm-hmm. But of course, in the modern world, that's really hard. And there are other cults that have sprung up that don't really have any tight information control. It's not like there's someone reading the mail. So one of the cults that's really intriguing is a group that some people now call a cult, which is followers of a YouTuber named Teal Swan, who calls herself like a spiritual entrepreneur, spiritual leader, some sort of thing. And a lot of people are saying this is a cult. There's a group called the Teal Tribe that is just very almost religious followers of this woman. Clearly, she can't control the information that people who are part of the Teal Tribe get. When they log off of the computer, they're logged off. Like, they're on their own time. They're not at a Scientology base. So they can get whatever information they want. But what she can do, and what the members of the Teal Tribe can do, is form themselves into a sort of echo chamber that becomes very self-policing, not only interpersonally self-policing, where they kind of police each other. So if you're showing signs of dissent in this group, you're going to get a talking to. Are you all right? What's going on with you? You know, all this stuff. Let's talk. But it's also intrapersonally self-policing. You get to a point where you might use Kafka traps. Like, if you have to talk to your relatives who believe that Teal Swan is full of shit, mm-hmm. and you take her seriously, you have a ready explanation for why you can discount those views. And it's a pretty useful tool for an echo chamber to have, which is a way to say, people who are critics of us just don't, maybe they don't know the truth. They're not in a position that we are. You can kind of dismiss them. And it's a fairly easy dismissal, and it makes it so that you don't have to entertain actual criticism. You don't have to sit with what they say and think about it, and how am I going to respond to this? you can say, I know how I'm going to respond to this. You obviously are so bought into mainstream, you know, bourgeois messaging that they want you to believe that I don't have to listen to you because I'm different.
Yeah. And so it's like the two kinds of discomfort that people don't like are being challenged. People don't like being challenged because that you have to entertain the possibility that you're wrong and that's unpleasant. And people don't like justifying themselves because that's hard. And hard things are unpleasant. And so this is a way to do something that's both easy and takes away the pain of being challenged, because it's not a real challenge, because it's not coming from an authentic place or something like that. You understand why the challenge is happening. You don't even have to answer the challenge, because the challenge isn't really about these claims. The challenge is about this person has a problem and they're just lashing out at you, right? It's like, it's like, you know, it's basically the equivalent of thinking, oh, you just haven't gotten enough sleep, right? Or you've drunk too much, right? Oh, yes. The people are out to get you. Sure. You know, that kind of thing. Yeah. So now here's the thing, though, that you said something about controlling the flow of information. One tactic I feel like I'm seeing a lot more of these days is a kind of guilt by association tactic. Like, if you follow so-and-so on Twitter, I don't trust you. Or if you're like, why are you reading that book? Right. You know, there's like this view almost that ideas are like diseases, and you can catch an idea if you get too close to it. Right. So better, you know, wall yourself off. And this reminds me of something that the blogger Scott Alexander talked about, the guy who used to do Slate Star Codex. Now he does a blog called Astro Codex 10. He had this way of dividing the world, which is, of course, a continuum rather than a clear dichotomy, but it's fun to think of it as a dichotomy. He said there are mistake theorists and there are conflict theorists. And the mistake theorists think that most of the reason why people disagree is because people have just made mistakes in reasoning, because reasoning is really hard because the world is a very messy place. And it's just hard to get things right. And then you have the conflict theorists who think that the best explanation of why people disagree is because their interests are opposed. And so because they have these competing, you know, Marx would be a conflict theorist because, you know, all these disagreements are a conflict between the working class and the capital class. And you could imagine, and, you know, you don't have to be a Marxist, obviously. You could have any political view is compatible with either view, I think, with both mistake theory and conflict theory. But I think if you endorse a conflict theory, you're going to be a lot more prone to using, intentionally or not, Kafka traps, just because you see, you know, interests as driving a lot of the disagreement people have with each other. And so once you know somebody's interests, you can sort of diffuse the challenge they give as a kind of veil for what they really want and just figure out, you know, how their interests are driving them. Now, interest is a bit broad because, you know, interests might mean you're psychologically messed up and not just I want your stuff. But it seems to me of a piece with conflict theory.
Probably more so because you're, again, going back to that term that the Nexians use, throwing an issue back on its author. It's more about what is driving the author rather than where is the mistake being made. But I mean, certainly you could still be susceptible or open to a Kafka trap if you are a mistake theorist. It would just be a very different Kafka trap. It would be the one that, you know, Nietzsche, Freud, Marx, whatever, like, well, you know, Marx, I guess, would be more of an interest theorist, but like, you're just making a mistake about your own internals, or you're just making a mistake about, you're just not in a position to understand the way things actually are.
Yeah, though I think because the mistake theorist usually thinks the world's really messy and complicated, they might conclude, and neither am I in a good position to understand.
Yeah, right. Which is why I said towards the beginning, I think one of the necessary conditions of a Kafka trap is you have to already be convinced of your priors. If you say, like, it's not enough for me to say, yeah, I don't know. You can't gauge yourself very well, because I could also say, well, neither can I. Like you said towards the beginning, if you follow, you can't read yourself very well with an I can.
Yeah.
Well, then you have the necessary ingredients, but that's a necessary condition, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. We should probably go soon. Before we do, have you looked at the Less Wrong community with Eliezer Yudkowsky?
I've heard of it. I don't think I have.
Some people call it a cult, because it talks about you have to go through the sequences, something they call the sequences, to like appreciate the views, and like these sequences
are like the word cult is becoming a very slippery kind of watered down term.
Yeah.
I think a lot of things are called cults that probably aren't. But
I agree, and I wonder to what degree people call things cults so that they can dismiss them and not have
dismiss
to deal
them.
Right.
Well, so here's another interesting point then, because we were talking before, you know, about like how like a Robin DiAngelo style anti-racism is susceptible to a Kafka trap. And I think it's kind of part of the book, at least the way she approaches it. But I don't want to put that only on the anti-racist theorists, because mm-hmm. I've noticed recently that someone like John McWhorter, who's an anti-racist, we might mm-hmm. call him, really sets up his own style of Kafka trap almost by calling this group a religion. Mm-hmm. So he says like anti-racism is a religion. They have a clergy, they have original sin. They have this fervency of belief that key to his point doesn't align with the evidence. That he's convinced that they're not really looking at the evidence. They have this motivation for almost like a religious belief. And the more I look at his work, it's like, well, he's setting up in some ways a Kafka trap of his own. What he's saying is they're a religion that doesn't really care about looking at the evidence because they have some interest in maintaining this belief. And they probably don't know they're in a religion. They would never admit it. I mean, right. So then you say to an anti-racist all this stuff and they say, no, like, this is serious. Let me give you some points of analysis. And mm-hmm. he'll say, see, you just don't know you're in a religion. You're just not interested in looking at the way things are.
Is that what he says though? Like he says, if you tell them that they're in a religion,
by effect, he does. So he'll say things in videos. Like he said, I was just watching an interview with him on the Michael Shermer podcast, God help me. And he said something about, and, you know, on this issue, anti-racists think it's all about race. And I think everyone secretly knows that it's not, but no one wants to say anything. Mm-hmm. Stop right there. Once you say that, mm-hmm. again, I don't think this is deliberate on his part. But once you say that, and I don't think anyone would ever admit this. Well, what is the anti-racist supposed to do to retort that?
So this sort of reminds me of an essay by a philosopher named Georges Ray. It's called Meta-Atheism. And Ray's thesis in this article was that most people are atheists. They just don't know they're atheists. But if you look at if you look at their behavior mm-hmm. is just what you'd expect if they had fully atheistic beliefs. And so basically what he's saying is that, like, and you know, you don't have to be an atheist to be a meta-atheist, right? Arguably Kierkegaard was a meta-atheist without himself being an atheist, right? Because mm-hmm. he attacked citizen Christians, right? Where he thought, you know, they're just going through the motions of Christianity, but they don't really believe it and stuff like that. But like, I read the essay and the way I responded to it was just by doing research. Like one of the examples was that, religious people grieve in just the same way that non-religious people do. But if you believe in an afterlife, why would you grieve in the same way? You should be happy. Mm-hmm. So a psychologist and I did research. We're like, do religious people grieve in the same way as non-religious people? Like, do people who consider them? And the answer was no, they don't actually. Now, they don't grieve massively differently. The difference was substantial, but not gigantic, which might make you think they didn't fully believe it, but they also kind of did believe it, right?
Well, when you ask religious people, like, why are you sad, you know, that your mother died, you're going to get an answer like, I won't be able to see her until.
Right, exactly.
Whereas for the atheist, so for the theist, it's still like, I grieve, but that's because there's a temporary gap, at least between.
I'm also sad when my son goes to college, right?
Right.
I would think if I were an anti-racist, I would respond to McWhorter by like trying to figure out, let's see if they actually do believe the things you think they secretly all don't believe, right?
Right.
Like maybe the behavior of these anti-racists is in fact different from behavior of non-anti-racists or anti-racists or whatever. But I mean, I don't know if that would work for him or not. And if it didn't work for him, then it might suggest that he's getting kind of I wouldn't say culty, but just kind of like, again, holding his beliefs in a religious way, right? Where it's not immune to evidence. And I confess, you know, there are some people who say stuff like academia is not liberal, right? Does not have a left-wing tilt. I hear people who say that, and they say that journalists don't have a left-wing tilt, you know, and I always find that very prima facie implausible. Like, and I always think there's going to be a trick played about what it means to be left-wing, where in order to be left-wing, you have to be like a communist or something.
And or so, it's going to be, right, or they're going to dismiss all the evidence as like anecdotal.
Right,
that's
right.
A small group you're pointing to.
It's or not if really you're, or if you, yeah. Or they're going to say, well, there was this big study done, but look who funded it. So we don't have to like respond to the study, that kind of stuff.
Right.
But I could be wrong. There are some things where it'd be so shocking to me if I were wrong, that it just like my giving up my belief would come pretty far down before I do a bunch of other things first.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And, but I, you know, that's not a Kafka trap thing. That's just like, you know, some beliefs are more, oh, well, you're not going to like this metaphor, but some beliefs are more deeply set in than other beliefs. And so are harder to dislodge, and perhaps rightfully so. But
yeah, well, there was a really interesting point on the Vow, the HBO series, the last episode. By the way, the other series is called Seduced, the Starz series. I just remembered it. Mm-hmm. On the last episode, one of the storylines was Catherine Oxenberg is trying to get her daughter India Oxenberg out of NXIVM. And she's one of the last members, and she's really extreme. And she's doing all the extreme stuff. And she reports having a conversation with her daughter. The scene is Catherine in a car, and where basically she's talking to the camera. And she recounts the conversation. And every bit of evidence that she threw at India, her daughter, India had a ready answer for. Mm-hmm. So like one of the things Catherine said was, well, if this isn't a cult, why is the FBI after Keith Raniere? Like surely he must have done something. And they're like, well, they don't like people who are renegades, and he's a renegade and he's about to change the world, and they don't like that. And then she said something like, well, what about these, you know, news articles that say he did this and he did that? Of course, you know what she's going to say. Well, why would you believe those people? Like, they have agendas. Then look at these things that NXIVM does. Isn't this kind of really strange? Like the rest of the world thinks this is strange. Then her answer is, yeah, you know, people thought that interracial friendships were strange at a certain point in time, but that doesn't mean they were.
Yeah.
She had all of the answers. And it's so clear that in terms of like what you said is these deep seated beliefs, like this had become so calcified in the NXIVM members that they could readily explain away, I guess, you know, all contrary evidence. And it just goes to, you know, your point earlier that one of the things that fascinates me about cults is they really show you how malleable belief is and how malleable interpretations of evidence can be.
Yeah.
Like what may seem obvious to me is not obvious to the India Oxenberg that was in NXIVM.
Like, yeah. So
we can say that she's wrong, but she's going to experience that as, well, that's just you being wrong.
Yeah. So it's funny because your point about the reason you're fascinated about cults is that they show you how flexible beliefs can be, how malleable beliefs can be, and how much interpretation plays a role in evidence. And other people would look at cults and draw exactly the opposite conclusion. It would show you how stupid people are, right? How stupid they can be, how malicious they can be, because the evidence is clear as day, right? That the earth is not flat, that, you know, there is no Q, that, you know, this and this and this. And yeah, it's an interesting, I don't know what to make of that. I guess I'm more prone to mistake theory, so I'd probably say that I side more with you. But
I don't think those two views are mutually exclusive. You could think that those people are stupid, and still think that belief is really that malleable that they can honestly believe this thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and I don't think you're going to be able to watch things like the
Vow. But the NXIVM people weren't stupid.
Oh yeah, I don't think you're going to be able to watch the Vow or Seduced and come away thinking that these people are stupid.
Yeah.
They're very, very smart at going back and analyzing how they went down this path.
Yeah.
And I just don't think someone who's that careful I don't think we can easily mistake them as stupid. But then again, isn't that its own sort of Kafka trap? Like, oh, you all are too stupid to realize what's going on. I mean, not that everything's a Kafka trap, but it is in its basic form.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. It makes it so that you don't really have to think about what led them down that path and why they saw evidence differently.
Yeah, I would say that stupidity would be the wrong word, right? Like anybody who's seriously going to look at the Nexium people and think of stupidity, they're going to have to say, we are very compartmentalized thinkers, right? And that it's very easy for a smart person to be stupid about something. Like, and by a smart person, you mean somebody who's generally quite good at abstract reasoning, is generally quite good at handling the data. But then, you know, you might look at Gödel. It'd be hard to look at Gödel and think this is a dumb guy, right? But, you know, some people look at his religious beliefs and think these were very dumb. Or they look at his beliefs that his wife was trying to poison him, right? Or not his wife, sorry, his caretaker. And that's why he starved himself to death, because once his wife died, like, he refused to eat because
he didn't trust anyone.
Yeah, and everybody's going to poison him. Although that seems to me not compartmentalized stupidity, just so much as a psychotic break or something like that. But yeah. Anyway, the cat is telling me we have to go. He needs more petting. Cool. So anyway, I will. Thanks for appearing.
Yeah,
you're a hard get, Kevin. Hard get. Yeah. You don't want to go on Sophia. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. No. It's. I'm good with it. I've been obsessed with Kafka traps for a while. So any chance to talk about them?
Okay. So when you say, do you want to talk about Kafka traps, and somebody says no, do you take that as evidence they do?
Yeah.
Yeah, good for you. All right. I'll see you later, Kevin.
See you.